You're my highest level of find me character.
Nice.
You're like level 8 or something.
What? Yeah. You're not level 8.
What? What are you? What am I? What level
I don't know. Like 3 or 4?
What? Really? Yep. You're beating out Sean. Sean's level 7 on my find me, and you're level 8.
Probably because I never clear mine out.
What's your highest?
Probably you.
Really? Oh, man.
My 3DS sits in my purse for weeks, and it dies, and then I don't know it died. And
like... Yeah, me too. Same thing. This guy's at like 20% right now.
It could be dead now. I don't know.
I always thought like there would be... I'm sure that there's like grade school kids or something that bring their 3DS every day and play Find Me at lunch, and they have like level 50 or level 80 characters.
There's got to be.
But I'm just happy if one of my characters does like 3 points of damage. I'm like, oh, this guy's awesome.
And then once some like ghost gets like a red shield, no red shirts ever again. Like, what the hell, game.
Welcome to the second episode of the Seattle Retro Gaming Podcast. I am Nathan Martin, co-founder of the Seattle Retro Gaming Expo, and I'm here with...
I'm Kinsey Burke, and I'm the PR and social media director for Seattle Retro Gaming.
Thank you for coming, Kinsey.
Of course.
We're here today to talk about Rushing Beat, Zelda 2, Atlas Games, PAX, Trivia, the SRGT, and anything else that interests us. As always, we start out our show with a shout out to our sponsor, Game Gurus. Game Gurus has two locations, one in Lake City Way, the other in Highway 99 and North 100th. Lane is the owner of Game Gurus. He has tons of used games for sale at both locations, and the 99 location has recently been renovated. They've added a back room filled with board games and an iPad that shows you everything he has in inventory. It's a really cool store. You should definitely check it out, or at least go to their website, www.seattlegameGurus.com, where you can learn about tournaments, get-togethers, and competitions held by our sponsor, Game Gurus. Be sure to check them out. This week, we have several segments. We're going to start by introducing you to Kinsey, our lovely PR and social media director for SRGE. We'll talk about some of the games we've been playing, get into our upcoming events at PAX and beyond, and then we will end the podcast with our first panel from the Seattle Retro Gaming Expo 2013, featuring the members of Arcade Armageddon. So look forward to that. All right, let's get started. So you met Kinsey in the introduction, and tell us a little bit about yourself, Kinsey.
Well, I've been working with the Seattle Retro Gaming Expo for either just about a year or just over a year. And I've been doing all of their PR and social media. So I do all of the daily Facebook posts, the Twitter, respond to everything, try to.
Yeah, if you follow the Twitter or the Facebook and you like the trivia questions, those are all Kinsey.
I do write those every day, in fact.
Yep. I noticed you finally got your question that you've been trying to put in the trivia night, the question block trivia, about the fantastic colors.
You know what? I love that question.
I know. You've been trying to get that into the question block trivia night for like 6 months or something. And every time I'm like, no, that's too hard. But
it's not hard.
I worked at Nintendo when those things came out, and I don't know what they are.
I just followed them crazily, so I knew them all, and I didn't work at Nintendo.
That's true. What were the pocket colors? You know that? The Game Boy Pocket?
You know what? How about we go to the next thing?
Okay. All right. So Kinsey also led the street team at the Seattle Retro Gaming Expo, and I personally believe that this was a big boon to our show. We had a lot of people come in that had not even heard about the show before the day of. They just said, oh, well, Princess Peach came up to us and told us about this show, and I thought that was really awesome, so I came out to check it out.
I did find a lot of lost show attendees out on the Seattle Center grounds, so we decided to mock up some sidewalk chalk art to try to help people on their way.
And and you'll also see Kinsey at a lot of our events. She has come to the game overnight at EMP. She is there every month for the question block video game trivia, helping me score the answer sheets and provide assistance when I'm trying to run the show and my computer's dying, which happens a lot. So thanks for coming out, Kinsey.
Of course, glad to be here.
All right. So our next segment is a little bit kind of a what you've been playing, sort of the de rigueur for video game podcasts. So one of our staff members has a house in Chelan. His family owns property out there, and he was kind enough to give it to us for the weekend. So we went out and had some nice relaxing decompression after the show.
It was very much needed after planning an entire expo.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, but very stressful. So it was nice to sit in the pool and get sunburned for a weekend.
Well, some of us did.
Yeah.
I got no burns.
Sure. All right. Yeah, I'll take it. All right. I got burned. I got burned bad, but it turned into a nice tan. I moisturized the heck out of it, and I think it's okay now. So, Kinsey, what have you been playing?
Lately, I've been playing Dragon's Crown since pretty much the day it came out. Every day.
Yeah.
And I've been playing it co-op, and it's just been wonderful going back to like the old beat 'em ups. I have spent many a quarter in the old Shadows of Mystara, and it really, really rings true to the beat 'em up genre, and I'm really enjoying it so far. I'm kind of angry though that the person who I'm playing with, his character has much cooler looking moves than mine does. But whatever. Mine's pretty awesome.
So I've only heard about Dragon's Crown mostly through all of the controversy with the hypersexualized characters and everything. But I'm just curious about the gameplay. Like you mentioned Shadows of Mystara. That's a classic beat-em-up, kind of a side-scrolling brawler. Is it just basically that?
It is. But it's really nice because it's a little bit more involved where you actually have a skill tree while you can earn skill points and kind of evolve your character how you want to. Like you're going to pick a character to begin with probably based on your playstyle to begin with. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually playing as the elf, who is the least sexualized of all the characters, which I'm actually loving. And she's wonderful for ranged, and she has all kinds of wonderful attacks that I'm learning. And then the person I'm playing with is playing as the dwarf. So it was kind of a really nice balance because originally I wanted to play as the Amazon, but...
So this is an Atlas game, right? So they have a lot of... Is there heavy story elements to it?
It's probably heavier than a lot of beat-em-ups are. It's not huge, but I'm actually really enjoying it so far. It has enough to keep you interested where you don't feel like you're just going through the levels and you kind of get lost in the story. So it's there.
That's cool.
And it's been fun so far.
All right. Yeah. So speaking of beat-em-ups with a storyline, while we were at Chelan, I got a chance to play a game that I've never seen before. It was called The Peacekeepers. And this was a Super Nintendo game. It was developed by Jellico in 1994. And it's actually the third in a series of games called Rushing Beat. The Rushing Beat series was released in Japan. In the U.S., it was three different games that were all released in the U.S., but none of them have any ties to each other. So they were known as Rival Turf, Brawl Brothers, and then The Peacekeepers. And I had no idea that these three games were tied together. Anyway, I thought they were just generic, you know, Final Fight clones. And it's a very interesting game. If you play the U.S. version of Peacekeepers, most of the music has been removed from the game. So you play through the game and you hear the psh, psh, psh from the fights, and you'll hear like some weird background sounds, but there's actually no background music. And it turns out it was just removed from the game. And I've looked online, but I haven't found a reason for that. It's a really weird thing, but... similar to Dragon's Crown, there's branching storylines. There's hidden characters that you meet only if you take like a certain path through the game to find that character.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's a really fun game, and I enjoyed it. It's something that I completely didn't care about because the box art was stupid.
Never judge a book by its cover.
I know, but this was pre-internet days. You judged all the games by the cover. It was, you know, you had, if it wasn't an EGM, all you had to go on was the cover and what it said on the back of the box. So that's what I did.
Every Friday night at Video Factory, I definitely judged every game there by their box art. I guess I shouldn't talk.
Yeah, so it was a fun game. It's a two-player brawler like a lot of the Super Nintendo games are. So I got a chance to play with Gerald, the other co-founder of the Seattle Retro Gaming Expo. He brought that game along with several others in the Super Nintendo. So he was the one who kind of turned me on to the Peacekeepers, and it was a lot of fun. I liked it. Another game that I've been playing is Zelda 2. And I actually played this when it first came out, and I love it. It's a great game. I think it's underrated. Miyamoto actually considers it his worst game or his least favorite game. Did you see that? There was an interview where somebody asked him, this was this year, what his least favorite game was. And he said it was The Legend of it was Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link. And
it's not that bad.
It's not a bad game. I like it. And the reason that Miyamoto cited for not liking this game was that it was originally a Famicom disk system game. So you would insert the disk and it would load the game. And apparently in the original, whenever you entered a town or if you entered a cave or a palace, anything, even a boss, or not a boss battle, a random fight in the game, it would take about 2 seconds. And you just get a big black screen that says, please wait, while it loaded off of the disk. And then it eventually would go into the town or the palace or whatever you were entering. And he felt that, Miyamoto felt that this killed the tone of the game and the pacing. And so for that reason, he didn't like it. But as a Western audience, you know, we never saw that issue with Legend of Zelda. It would, if you play the game, it just goes seamlessly into whatever you're doing. So I feel like it was kind of a missed opportunity. I think Miyamoto said that he wanted to do more with the platform that he had developed for Zelda 2, but he chose not to because of that limitation. So we kind of got shortchanged because of the Famicom disk system limitations. There are some nice things about the Famicom disk system. In particular, Kinsey, I have a treat for you.
All good.
I found out that the Famicom disk system does have a unique sound chipset. Not necessarily better, but just different. And so I tracked down some of the Legend of Zelda 2 music and brought it here today so we can kind of see the differences. Now, my understanding is that the vast majority of the music for this game is the same as what you find in the US version, but the opening title has a song that is more enhanced in the Famicom disk system. So I thought I'd play that for us today.
Sweet, let's hear it.
All right, I'm going to start out with playing just a sample, about 20 seconds of the US version. So if you haven't heard it before, you'll have kind of a baseline, or if you haven't heard it in a long time. So here's the US version of Zelda 2. So that was the original Zelda 2 music. Excuse me, not the original. That was the NES version, the US version. So here we'll play the beginning of the Famicom Disk System version of the Zelda 2 intro music. And you can see it's clearly different. I don't know if I would call it better necessarily, but you can definitely tell there's a little bit more processing power behind this music. And by the way, for what it's worth, for whatever reason, the songs are just ever so slightly different tempos. So they go at different speeds, and they're also at different like pitches or something. I'm not a music person, but if you play the two at the same time, which is what I originally wanted to do, it sounds terrible.
I'm so sure it does.
Maybe I'll play that for you later. But for now, I think we can move on.
Well, lately I've been kind of a smattering of trying out some games to see what I actually want to spend some time and play. I've still have yet to beat BioShock Infinite. I feel like I've been in the Comstock house for weeks.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I got about 3 hours in. I haven't even picked up the girl. What's her name?
Elizabeth.
I haven't even picked her up yet, and I just never got back to it. I need to do that. I haven't been spoiled yet either, so I'm kind of lucky.
Yeah, you are. It's everywhere.
Yeah, for my part, I haven't really been playing too much else. The only other thing that I played that I thought was really cool was Oregon Trail. It's not Oregon Trail, the classic you know, Apple II game that everybody played in high school.
You might still get some dysentery, though.
I did. My character got dysentery. It's based on Oregon Trail, the original, but it's Oregon, O-R-G-A-N, and it is a zombie apocalypse in the style of Oregon Trail. So you have a station wagon instead of a covered wagon, and you're trying to get from, I think, New York to Oregon, I think to Portland. And it's a great game. It's a lot of fun. I'll include a link. There's a free Flash version, but the game was also released as a director's cut through Steam, and you can pick it up that way as well, and they add some new elements to it. So I think that covers what we've been playing. Yeah. All right. Just a few more things. We're going to get into the Chiptunes panel from SRGE 2013 in just a few minutes, but there are a few things that we thought you'd like to know. First of all, one of the surprise hits at the Seattle Retro Gaming Expo was the Seattle Retro Gaming t-shirt. It's a simple t-shirt that includes our logo, which has four icons on it, one for Seattle, one for retro, one for gaming, and one for expo. And we actually sold out of that shirt at the show, and we had people asking when they can buy more of them. And I'm happy to announce that we do have more available. They will be available on our website very shortly, if not by the time this podcast is released. So go to seattleretro.org or check out our Facebook page or our Twitter, where we'll announce where and how you can buy that shirt. You can find the SRGET or the SRGT at our website. We're going to try and make them available at PAX as well.
It's a pretty awesome shirt. Every time I wear it, like out and about, somebody comments on it. Like just recently, probably at Shorty's last week, someone came up to you and was like, wow, that's an awesome shirt. Like,
cool. Yeah, I like it. I wear it. I have two right now, and I've had one in particular I've had since the first Seattle Retro Gaming Expo, so it's not doing so hot. I'm looking forward to replacing that and having a new shirt that's actually black and not gray by way of black.
Well, the shirt's going to be at PAX. And so are we.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, SRGTs will be available on a website. We're also going to have them available at PAX. We have the Question Block Trivia, our monthly video game trivia night, which is hosted by me with the invaluable assistance of Kinsey.
I try.
Helping to write the questions and also to grade the answer sheets at our trivia nights. We're going to be at PAX on Saturday at 8:30 p.m. in the Serpent Theater. We're going to allow teams of up to four to compete for up to six rounds, and we'll have prizes provided by PAX and by the Seattle Retro Gaming Expo. So if you can't afford a t-shirt, but you do have a ticket to PAX, that might be a good opportunity for you. The questions will be multiple choice. If you attended the trivia night at the Seattle Retro Gaming Expo, you've got a good idea of what to expect. And we're going to do everything we can to grade 50-plus teams at the same time and keep everybody from waiting. So we're going to do our best there, and we can't wait to do it.
Super excited about this. It was so much fun pretty much all year at our monthly trivia nights at the Wild Rover, and then it was a blast at SRGE. So I'm actually extremely excited to bring this to PAX.
Yeah, I can't wait. I hope that you will enjoy it. We're doing our best to get some new questions in there. We're going to make them a little bit harder because we know the PAX attendee in general is a little more savvy about video games. So look forward to some difficult questions. Again, that's Saturday, 8:30 p.m. in the Serpent Theater, which is actually inside the Sheraton. It's where Giant Bomb had their podcast panel last year. All right, and the last thing we have to talk about today before we get to our Chiptunes panel featuring Arcade Armageddon is a contest. So if you want to go to PAX but you do not have a PAX badge, this is your chance. SRGE has four-day passes to PAX Prime 2013 that we're going to give away. It's going to be very simple. All you have to do is like our page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. There's going to be two ways to win. So we're going to give away two of those badges through the Facebook page and two of them through the Twitter account. So if you like our page on Facebook, if you follow us on Twitter, you're good to go. Sometime in the next day or two, we're going to post something on Facebook for you to share. Everyone who likes our page and shares this item is automatically entered to win. On Twitter, we're going to make a post and ask you to retweet it. Every person who follows us at Seattle Retro and retweets that post will be entered to win one of those two tickets. So please like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, and await further instructions. All right. Without further ado, we're going to turn things over to our Chiptunes panel. This was our first panel on our first day at the Seattle Retro Gaming Expo. It was the Arcade Armageddon panel featuring Dan Crowdis, who is the Icarus Kid, now of the Icarus Kids. He's added some people to his team and now has a live experience, which is great. It also features Raheem Jarbo, aka Random. You might also know him as Mega Ran. He is the only chip hop artist, I believe, that is officially licensed by Capcom. And that's a great story, and the music is awesome. So he's a great guy to listen to. And then finally, we have Dan Barons, Danimal Cannon. He's part of Arm Cannon, if you've heard of them. And he has an interesting take on chiptunes music and what it means to him. All right, we'll get to the panel in just a few moments, but first we want to wrap things up here.
First of all, we definitely want to thank our sponsor, Game Gurus, for helping us make this podcast possible. And our music today was provided by the Icarus Kids, which is available on Spotify, Bandcamp, and of course their website, theicaruskid.com. You can find the links to the different things we mentioned today in our show notes. And of course, more information about the Seattle Retro Gaming Expo can be found on our website, seattleretro.org. And at facebook.com/SeattleRetro, and of course, also via Twitter at Seattle Retro, or on iTunes at Seattle Retro Gaming Podcast. Please vote for us, and we will read all of our 5-star reviews on the podcast.
All right. My name is Nathan. You can find me on Twitter at Another Fluke.
And my name is Kinsey, and you can find me on Twitter at Kinzilla. Thank you all for listening, and please email any questions or suggestions to podcast@SeattleRetro.org. We read every email and we'll try to respond to everything.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Sorry about the wait there. This is our first year with panel, so we're getting kind of stuff kicked off here. So the great pleasure of introducing Dan Crowdis from the Icarus Kids, part of our Arcade Armageddon. So Dan, you want to go ahead and run through and give a brief overview of the panel and all that?
Yeah, sure. So what we're here today is that all three of us are taking a different approach to chiptunes, chiptune music being music that's created with old video game hardware to create modern electronic music. And I'm here with Arcade Armageddon, which is a video game concert and tournament taking place later tonight at the Vera Project. All three of us will be performing there. And for the tournament portion, we'll be over in the free play room running a Nintendo World Championships, which is Tetris, Mario 1, and Rad Racer. You play all three and get a total score. So the top 20 scores are going to the finals over at Vera Project to compete on stage in a number of other games. So for this panel, I figured all three of us will just talk a little bit about how we got started, how we got into chiptunes, you know, talk about what we're currently doing, and then we can take questions about just any topic that y'all might like to think of. All right. How about you? One of y'all start.
All right. My name is... Is this on? Yeah, it is. My name is Raheem Jarbo. I make music under the name Random, a.k.a. Mega Ran. I'm a former teacher who uses, I would say I do what's, I guess, could be called chip hop, a combination of chip tunes and hip hop music with some sort of educational undertones occasionally. And I have been occasionally referred to as a nerdcore hip hop artist. So, yeah, that's me.
My name is Danimal Cannon, and I make music on Nintendo Game Boys, among other things. And essentially, I try to make really wanky shred prog music on this platform because essentially chip music lends itself to really, really melodic ideas sometimes. Because essentially what it does really well is melody, and it doesn't do a whole lot of other things really well. But we end up making it do that other things anyways. essentially, I really enjoy that sort of platform for the limitations that it provides, and then approaching those limitations and like having it influence the way that I compose music. Because it turns out when you know you have these really strict parameters of what these like old sound chips can do, it actually like super influences where you take the music, and it actually makes it have a very unique sound to it. And I don't know, I really just fell in love with this sound of the old chips, and like you really don't see composition quite like it. So I actually really prefer to work in Medium, even though it's a very limiting platform. And then I guess just to finish that up, you know, after working with Game Boys for a long time, I actually started to get a lot of soundtrack work composing for video games because people wanted that very specialized old school retro sound, just like people were looking for, you know, pixel artists and stuff like that. And I also do other kinds of composing as well. So it was kind of like a good foot in the door to like get into composing for video games because I just had this specialized, you know, niche talent that I had. So I kind of do that now with just playing shows and video game composing.
Cool. My name is Dan Crowdis. I go by the Icarus Kid, although I've recently switched to the Icarus Kids. So at first, 4 years ago, I wasn't technically creating chiptune music, but what I did is I took all of my Nintendo NES games and sampled them for like 3 weeks and built this gigantic library of both sound effects and music. And then I took these samples and I arranged them to create an album. So I was trying to kind of, instead of creating new sounds with the chips, I wanted to capture not just the sound of the chips, but the kind of sounds that the composers from back in the 80s were putting into these chips and the way that they were able to manipulate them. And we also have these very recognizable sounds from all these games that we're used to. And using them in the same way that any other electronic producer would use samples, only kind of making that as the soundscape. So I've been doing that as a live, a solo live performance, kind of halfway between DJ and live for years. And it was fun, but after a while, I was kind of bored of doing the solo thing, so now I have a five-piece band. So this was less electronic. We're doing arrangements of video game music, and we're still keeping that electronic edge, but it's a lot more live.
So I just want to like say something about like going back and you know sampling the old game music. It's funny because I used to go and download like every single game soundtrack, you know, from the NES. You can actually download a zip file of every single isolated soundtrack. And what's cool is you can actually break it apart and like get the individual components and then slow them down and see how they happen. So like just as a total geek out moment, I would like take the sound effects which were encoded in the files of, like, let's say Mega Man 3 or something, and then I would slow them all down and figure out how they actually made them, because it turns out, like, the old composers, you know, back when they were composing for NES games, like, they had to use these really weird creative tricks in order to, like, trick the viewers into thinking, like, oh, a sword just got hit or an explosion just happened, and you'd have to use either really just odd or strange musical devices at, you know, 128th note triplet speed, you know, which is completely inhuman. But it turns out that, like, you know, old game consoles, what they can do well is they can do things very fast, and so you end up with these really odd sounds. And I like loved picking them apart and like figuring out how they were made and stuff like that. So I think we geeked out in the same way, and then just approached it a little differently.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. The way, because the synthesizers for these old systems are extremely limited, but the composers were able to do amazing things with them by taking it a different approach. Like he's saying, like instead of to create a sound effect, you actually take a synthesizer and speed it up so fast that it doesn't even sound like a standard synthesizer anymore. But we've gotten used to those sounds as representing that's what video game sounds are supposed to be. And it all came from these random Japanese composers in the early 80s being like, how can we use these simple tools to mix sound effects?
So are any of you guys musicians in here? Okay, a couple of you. So like, do you use like modern software, like whether it's, you know, Reason or Cubase or Logic or, you know, there's a couple different ones that I use. And the object of this software when you try to make music today is it's the most intuitive, nice, easy, never crashing, you know, like, you know, I want this note here to go this long and, you know, put an effect on it. And they want to make that as easy and as intuitive for you to use. But back in the day when they were composing old, like, NES music, they were literally coding it, like, in assembly by hand. And it was the most ass-backward, awful process where they'd have to, like, guess and check. And they were actually, like, a combination of, like, computer programmers and, like, composers at the same time. Like, you couldn't be one or the other, or else you'd either make really bad music or you wouldn't be able to get your music actually onto the platform. So it's kind of interesting, the tools that they use. When your tools are sufficiently limited, it actually directly influences how you write music. And I don't know, it's kind of cool to see where it's come from, like, back then to today. You know, we're still influenced by these people writing computer software, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I kind of geeked out on that for a second.
All right. Does anybody have any questions or topics of discussion like this to talk about?
I'll kind of cheat since I have a mic. So I'm interested because somebody just came off a Japan tour. So I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit and the whole Kickstarter experience and just like that, because it was pretty exciting to watch, like, as a bystander and somebody who's kind of casually interested. So I thought it was really cool how that all turned out.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it was interesting to watch. After the ulcers and the headaches of, you know, having to worry about making the goal, I'm sure everybody here knows how Kickstarter works. If you're not funded, you get nothing. So we raised funds. There was a gentleman who's over in Japan now, a filmmaker, who offered us an opportunity to come to Japan, not just to perform, but to create a tour, basically, that would involve myself and a lot of the top chip musicians and video game composers probably in either industry, and create a tour around that he would document, film, and create music around that we would record. So we started the process probably a little late, but I think we launched the Kickstarter E3 week, which we thought was a bad idea, but timing and everything was, it just had to happen that way. And I just got back, and it was just a completely, you know, moving, motivating, and enlightening experience. Not sure if any of you guys have been to Japan, but I highly recommend it. It's the mecca for, you know, the things that we enjoy. And just being around people who think about it, you know, the music that we do in a different way and approach it in a different way was great. But the process, you know, again, was it's very difficult, but it was a lot of fun to create. And to get out there and play with guys like Omodaka, like there's a group by the name of Denshi Kaiman, which is created by the composer of Street Fighter IV and a bunch of other great games. We met so many great people, and just to be able to not only meet them but to play with them was extremely, extremely humbling and exciting. So hopefully, just be on the lookout for that. We're working on a Blu-ray documentary and all this other cool stuff that's happening. Just so relieved that, you know, the process of waiting and wondering if you're gonna make the Kickstarter goal is over. So I'm really, really, like, relieved to go on with the rest of life after this. So now we have to create the content. So I'm really excited about that.
I've got a question for you actually about that.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm having, like, my own panel. No. How would you compare the response, you know, towards, like, let's say your sort of, you know, chip hop music from America to, like, what you received in Japan? Like, was there a difference in the kind of response that you got?
I was worried about that, but I don't think there was much of a difference. Crowds are very responsive. I feel like the music that we make, it just transcends, you know, language barriers or anything like that. And, you know, people are there to have a good time and to reminisce, and we're able to provide that service. So they were just really into it, you know. And, I mean, it helps that a lot of my stuff is backed by popular tunes. And so, you know, these tunes have been a part of Japanese culture for forever. You know, when I mentioned Rockman, just walking down the street, I think I had a shirt on. It was one of my own shirts, and they looked at it like, Rockman, oh, you know. And it was like a group of, like, school-age kids who just almost simultaneously busted out the Dr. Wily theme. Like, I was like, this is so cool. Like, school age kids in the States aren't, you know, that familiar with that kind of stuff. So I thought that was awesome. So just being able to, you know, the relatable source material helps a lot. But I think the general, you know, crowd participation aspect of my performance is something that I feel is made for that type of situation. So it's able to kind of draw them in a little bit. And I do feel like it transcends. So it was a really smooth transition and a lot of fun.
Cool.
I'm going to perform in Tokyo later this year, but so I've only heard secondhand. But essentially, chip music in Japan, over in the States, it's a, kind of like it's in its own category. It's almost like not recognized by like the electronic music community. It's almost like two separate things. But over in Japan, supposedly, I don't know this because I haven't been there yet. But essentially, it's kind of considered just the same as like any other kind of electronic music, and it kind of fits into like the same music scenes, you know, that you might see in the house music scene or, you know, the dubstep scene or something like that. It's just sort of another branch of popular electronic music. It's not really looked at as like this weird niche kind of music. I don't know. I think they're much more accepting of like that sort of sound palette. It's not occasionally in the States it's looked at as sort of a novelty, and over there it's much more of like a legitimate art form. And I don't know, I think that's really cool, and hopefully we can change some minds in the States.
Yeah.
All right, questions?
Oh, there's a mic up there. Oh, okay. Step up to the mic. Yeah. Right. Step on up.
So, kind of on the same note, generally, why do you guys think, not just chiptunes, but just video games in general, like especially older games, are more culturally mainstream in Japan versus the United States? Like, even though we have like at least a generation or two that have grown up with older games, why is it like something that's normal for Japanese culture to embrace, whereas here everybody's like, oh, don't talk about that? Or, you know, even though Halo 4 or Halo 3 is selling like hundreds of millions of copies, and, you know, but everybody acts like it's not there, you know?
It's gotta be a cultural thing. I think they're more adorable over there or something.
More adorable.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I am talking out of my ass 100% right here. like, you know, maybe... actually, I don't even want to say what came to my mind right now. Like, maybe after World War II, they were demilitarized, and so they have a less military-based culture. And I'm totally talking out of my ass right now. I don't have anything to back this up with. I'm just speculating here. I don't know. They're into a lot more adorable things over there. And I don't know, old games, you know, new games are a lot more serious, which isn't a bad thing. You know, it's just different. You know, in America, we love football, guns, and, you know, that's pretty much it.
That's it.
But, you know, over there, they like, you know, it's much more mainstream to be into fantasy and, you know, panties and stuff. So,
yeah,
I need to stop talking right now. I just... Yeah, this is going to, like, go online or something and be like, no, no.
Sounds like you're going to have a lot of fun in Tokyo.
Yeah, I will. I know what I'm getting into.
Yes. I'm not sure either. I mean, it could just be a cultural thing. We're just not, I don't know, we're taught from an early age, like, you know, the video games are a kid thing and that, you know, it's time to grow out of them. I can remember going to college and my mom saying that, like, all right, no more games, you know, so... I had to leave all my game systems at home, and I missed out on some really great stuff, you know? So I couldn't play games until I went home on breaks and things. So I could just think it's just a cultural thing where they're raised to respect and appreciate and keep those things in, you know, heart and mind, and we're raised to, you know, move on and be a grown-up and things like that. So that's really all I can think of.
I think it's also the fact that games have only just become mainstream in our culture, and the games that become mainstream, the people that are the games that, you know, adults are playing, they have to be all tough, you know, like you're saying, all militaristic. And you think of the Wii and the games that are coming out there where they're trying to be family friendly, but they might not have that kind of family friendly connotation in Japan. To them, it's just video games. Like, they don't have to pass this magical, like, cool factor. Whereas, you know, back when it was still the NES and the SNES, it was mostly kids playing it in the U.S., and it's only today that adults gaming is a normal thing.
That's very true.
Yeah, good point.
So you've talked a little bit about age. I'm curious how age demographics play into your shows, where you think the majority of the audience is, and also any anecdotes you have about youngest fan, oldest fan, each one of you.
That's a good one. For the most part, my fans are probably in my age bracket. I'm 35, so usually I guess 30 plus is what I expect. A lot of 80s babies who grew up on the things that I grew up on. I don't know. Is it similar with you guys? I get a lot of mostly male fans that come to shows, but every once in a while I get surprised. I have some young fans who come out who enjoy the things. I'm like, wait, how do you know about that? You know, this came out before you were born. You know, but you mentioned some games that have transcended, you know, space and time, like a Final Fantasy VII, and there are people in every generation almost that seem to know something about it, which is really awesome. So I get surprised a lot. I had a hard time getting one of my, I think it was last time I was in Seattle, actually, I had a 12-year-old who was asked me to ask his mom, you know, if she would come to the show and bring him, because he really wanted to see the show. And I was just like, that's so exciting to me. Like, that is awesome. So I gave him a bunch of merch and posters and stuff. And like, and his mom actually came, and I thought that was really cool. So yeah, like every once in a while I get surprised, but most of the time my, the fans of my music are probably people who grew up around the same time, you know, with the 8-bit generation, and continue to keep a soft spot in their hearts for it. So that's my story, though.
I got like a 2-part answer here. So with games, it's kind of like analogous to music in that, like, now we have like the classic rock of games. Like there's the classics, you know. So like, while you might go to like some young kid and be like, dude, you got to check out Led Zeppelin, like, you know, they're incredible, like you can't not check out Led Zeppelin, and you might do the same thing where you say, like, you have to play Super Metroid. Like, it's just one of those games you have to play. It doesn't matter what age you are. Like, you have to go back and check it out because it's one of the best design games of all time. And so there's these classics that definitely transcend, you know, age. You know, I know, you know, 16-year-old kids who are, you know, into the Beatles. And I think it's now that there's, like, that body of, like, classic gaming, you know, that it graduated because Atari was awful. it really was. I've tried to play Atari recently, but it there's definitely these classics that definitely transcend age, which is really cool. So, you know, you might see a 12-year-old wearing a Zelda shirt, you know, although I guess Zelda's still going on, so that's the worst example I could have given. but on the other side of this topic with original chip music, which is what I tend to make, but I also do remixes of video game music. It very much tries to stand on its own as a separate thing, as opposed to like not enjoying chip music because you love the Legend of Zelda theme. It's more so about like creating something new and original, as opposed to like standing on the shoulders of giants, which is cool, like for different reasons. And one of the coolest things is there's actually a huge young population that's into old chip music. I've played festivals, and a lot of the fans are 17, 18, and they never grew up with an NES or a Game Boy or anything like that, and they love the sound that it comes out of it. And what's really cool about that is it shows me that it's not just the novelty of, like, you know, enjoying the Super Mario theme and, like, oh, this reminds me of video games. Like, yeah. It's more of, like, oh, this is a legitimate sound palette, and you can actually make really cool things out of it, and it's not just nostalgia that's driving the enjoyment of, like, that cool sound that's coming out of these instruments. So I have had a lot of really younger fans, you know, 17, 16, 15, that surprised the hell out of me, and I love it. And it further justifies that it's not just nostalgia driving it. It's a cool, independent sound palette.
Yeah, it's about the same for me. I like the comparison with classic rock because it's really true. You know, you're in high school and you're like, oh, this stuff's cool from the 70s. And, you know, I've played a Fender Rhodes electric piano, which is, those, you know, they stopped being made in the late 70s. and they were really big back then, but I was like, oh, it's cool because it's retro. And I think the teenagers now and that are creating chip music, it's like the same kind of thing. Like, you know, they didn't grow up with it, but like this is cool retro thing that they can kind of create their own scene. So for myself, yeah, it's been all across the spectrum, largely because of that. I have, you know, like people my age that grew up with the games and are there for the nostalgia, and then have like the younger people that are into chip tunes or just into retro video gaming to be into it. And then everywhere in between, where because we're just trying to, I've always tried to make music that's accessible, even if you aren't into games, just like good dance music. So yeah, it's been all across the board for me.
Good question. Next.
So I'm just wondering, what do you guys think in terms of pop culture? Which genre of music will actually embrace chiptunes first? Because I've noticed that, like, I've heard a few songs, like Wiz Khalifa sampled something from.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot
which song
was from Super Nintendo's one. Even on Magna Carta, Holy Grail, like, I was like, this is very chiptune inspired.
Tom Ford on Magna Carta had some chip inspired stuff.
I was wondering, like.
Yeah, the last few years have been crazy like that.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if Jay-Z's doing it, like, what's going to be the next step in terms of that? Like, is it going to be something where we're going to see, like, DJ sets from Tiesto all in, you know, chiptunes in the future? Like, what do you guys think?
I feel like it's close to happening. I don't know if people even, I mean, if you ask Jay-Z, he wouldn't know. He didn't make the beat, so he has no clue. He just showed up and rapped on it. So a lot of times I think the producers are definitely, I don't know if Timberland did that one.
There's a story about
there
Timberland.
There is a story. I'll let you tell that one. A lot of, and I was kind of going to get into that, is that it's a difficult thing because a lot of them don't respect necessarily the chip art or the video game side of it. So I feel like, I don't know because I'm not necessarily in the electronic scene, but I feel like it's very close to being accepted in the electronic dance scene because of the similarities in creation methods and sounds. I was really excited to see Anna Managuchi, like, on Billboard, you know, right next to, like, Daft Punk, you know. And so I feel like it's very close, and it's just, I guess it's a matter of time, but I do feel like the dance electronic scene will, if they haven't already, embrace those elements probably the most and first.
Anna Managuchi's on Jimmy Kimmel. Yeah. That says something.
That's
right there.
That's awesome. Like, every time they win, it's a small, you know, exactly, win in all of our hearts. We're like, oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah, they were on Lollapalooza last year, and yeah. I don't know. That's definitely, like, arguably the biggest chip act is Anna Managuchi right now, and they're totally great dudes, and it's really cool to have, you know, people from a scene who have been in it for years and are doing a fantastic job of it and are totally legit to be the ones who are successful, as opposed to somebody just cashing in on, like, you know, something they thought might be cool, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's definitely different grades. It's just cool to, like, have a group like that that really is awesome. What I do want to say is there is this story about Timbaland sampling chip music. Mm-hmm. And hip-hop is had roots in sampling for a long time, and what's cool about that is it's essentially like derivative art, sort of like remixing a video game tune and like taking this song and turning it into a completely new piece of art. And with sampling, they would take, like, let's say, like, an old funk song and like take 5 seconds of it and turn it into something new and mess around with it. But what Timbaland did is he took this finished chiptune artist song. And he took the whole song. It's not like sampling like a little, you know, bit of it. Because there's a difference between sampling and then taking a whole song. That's just theft. Because you're not actually creating something really new out of it. Or at least you're taking way more than you should. And he took this whole song, and it actually turned into this Nelly Furtado song called Do It, which was a famous song in like 2006. And it was funny because all of a sudden people were like, hey, this is this guy Tempest song, like, did you let him do that? And he's like, no. And it was bad because it wasn't even just a small sample, it was a huge sample. And you know, I guess where I'm going with that is chip music has kind of been creeping its way into mainstream music for a long time. I see Toyota commercials that have chip music in it, you know, in it once you have an ear for it, you can pick it out instantaneously. And it's been creeping in like really gradually over the last 5 or 6 years. And if I will be very surprised if it's not much more of a mainstream type of music in, you know, the next few years, especially with some acts really starting to break out. Because essentially a lot of people, you know, every time I play a show, there's people who don't know that any of this ever existed. You know, they're like, see me, you know, like making music on Game Boys, and they're like, I've never heard anything like that. And that's, to me, that's really cool. But it also means that there's so many more fans out there that don't know that they're fans yet. You know, they just haven't had the exposure to know that this is a thing that even exists. And so once the mainstream exposure to, you know, this sort of music happens, then I feel like a lot more people will be like, oh, wow, this is a thing that I'm totally into. I just didn't know about it yet. Just like any other kind of weird kind of music.
Yeah. I wanted to bring up, you didn't bring up, like, Timbaland's response when he was when he was like outed on the sample. I don't remember his exact quote, but he completely like dismissed it. Like, it's some stupid game music. So what? Like, it was, that was his response. And wow. I'm just like, oh, hip hop loses again, you know?
Did you take him to court?
Settled out of court.
Oh, they settled out of court. I'm sure he paid up a bunch, I'm sure. But
non-disclosures and shit.
Oh yeah. But yeah, his response immediately was like, yeah, it was some stupid game. And like, it was like, really? Because at that point, no one had, you know, respected game music as music. Mm-hmm.
I think we're starting to, it's just like we were talking about before, of our generation coming into age, and both musicians and like advertisers are realizing that these sounds, these trip sounds, they like strike a chord for us, and they have that instant relatability. Like, you just, you know, you put that Game Boy sound in an electronic tune, and all of a sudden that's just thousands and thousands of people, millions, that can just instantly relate to it just by hearing that sound. So I think that's why we're starting to see it more and more, is that this kind of music has been on the edge for a while, but mainstream music, it always takes like a little bit from the niches and then kind of puts it all together.
Come on down.
So what, in your opinion, is, this is kind of a specific question, what in your opinion is some of the best chiptune music on, like, I guess specifically the NES and Game Boy, but working within the limitations of the hardware? So not just like best NES music or best Game Boy music, but the best implementation of the limitations that the hardware gives you.
Are you talking about people who are writing new stuff now or from like old
games? I mean classic, like your guys' opinion on classic stuff.
Classic stuff? There's a game, it's Castlevania 3, but in Japan it was released as Akuden Densetsu, and it actually employed this extra sound chip that they built into the game to like get more sound channels out of it, and it's one of the coolest, most like crazy sounding soundtracks I've ever heard in my life. The Ninja Turtles 2 and 3 games are incredible, in my opinion. Like, just the melodies used, all the Mega Man soundtracks are pretty incredible. I mean, it's almost like the heavy hitters. There's a couple different ones. There's this composer named Tim Fallon that back in the day, he took the essentially the platform to its craziest limits. So he did a couple games, Silver Surfer, which is completely unplayable, but it has like this incredible soundtrack. And then he wrote Solstice. It also has a really crazy soundtrack. And then another guy, or another game he did was Pictionary, and you wouldn't expect Pictionary to need like this off the wall crazy shred prog soundtrack, but he did it anyways because why not. So anything by Tim Fallon is really just like almost more complex than a lot of the modern chip stuff where people are trying to take it to crazy limits. He's one of those, like, I don't know, original gangsters that's just like on his own level.
I recommend anything by Hip Tanaka, who was kind of like the number two guy at Nintendo back in the day. Koji Kondo is doing Mario and Zelda.
Which ones did Hip Tanaka do? I mean, I know.
He did Metroid. He did Wrecking Crew, Kid Icarus. The rest is escaping me right now. But he did a lot of like the weird stuff. And like very, very early Nintendo, like before, like when the games all still had the same covers that looked alike. And he did a lot of, like, he would use, like, the triangle as melody and, like, put the pulse in the bass and stuff like that. And but like you were saying also, if you check out the Famicom disc system, because that's the games that have that extra sound channel, and that's when you get to hear, like, a lot of the games that are ported over to the U.S.
we didn't have that hardware available here, so you're missing out. Like Kid Icarus is a good example. There's an extra melody line in the Japanese version of that game.
Really?
So you check it out on YouTube, because there's a lot of, like, it's not that many games, but the FDS, Famicom Disk System, that's where you can go and you can find these hidden gems.
There's actually an extra melody in Zelda 2, and it blew my mind.
Yes.
And it sounds wrong because I'm so used to hearing Zelda in that way it is. And
really?
So with this extra melody, I mean, it's there and they wrote it, but like it feels wrong to me to hear it. So I don't know, just because it's so ingrained in my soul of what it should sound like.
Wow.
Yeah, that's another.
It's the opposite of Kid Icarus for me. Like I heard that and I was finally like, it's finally complete. That makes sense now.
Any more questions? Nice shirt, by the way.
Thank you. I was wondering what kind of tools you guys use to create your music, if you use original hardware or if it's just entirely on a computer, or how mix of the two?
I'm adding new hardware as I go. Right now, I just got started on like tracking software, Famitracker. But for the most part, I've started very simple, then got complex, then got simple again. I started with FL Studio and a MIDI keyboard, then moved into Reason, then some hardware I got was an MPC, Muesli for drum programming. Then moved, scaled back a little bit, and got into Cubase and Logic. And so right now, For production, it's mostly Reason and Logic. And for live performance, I just got a Famicom from Japan that's kind of hacked up, and I've been working with that. It's been pretty fun. And I sequence and run stuff out of Logic or GarageBand if I need to. So it's just a matter of whatever I need at the moment and whatever can make the sound that I want to make at that particular time. So it kind of varies for me.
Currently, since I compose on the Game Boy, I use this custom ROM that somebody wrote that's a sequencer. It's called LSDJ. And it's really, it's a tracker software, which means it looks a little different than like a traditional piano roll interface, and it's in hex code, and you're going to hate your life learning how to do it. But once you learn it, it's actually a really cool, intuitive, really quick interface. I can actually write faster on that now that I've learned it. And that's generally what people use to make Game Boy music. There is another program that called Nanoloop that's slightly less popular. But it's a really cool interface. And the one thing I do want to say about, you know, making chip music is LSDJ costs $2 for the software because it's just homebrew software that somebody made. I mean, you could probably steal it, but why would you for $2 just support the guy? And then, like, Famitracker that you were talking about before, that's for composing NES music. That's free online. And it's really cool that you can get the tools that you need for almost, you know, $0. I usually compose in an emulator, actually, a Game Boy emulator, because it's easier to see the screen than on my actual Game Boy. And, you know, if you were to go pick up, you know, some of these programs to make music, let's say, like, Logic or, you know, Cubase or FL Studio, you can drop hundreds and hundreds of dollars into that, and there's definitely a barrier to entry. Meanwhile, you know, if you're just interested in making music, like it's actually a really cool platform to be able to make, you know, music cheaply. You don't need a MacBook Pro and like, you know, a crazy setup in order to do it. And so you actually see chip music starting to emerge in like I don't want to say it because it sounds derogatory, but like poorer countries. It's coming out a lot in Indonesia and Brazil. And like other countries that I can't name off the top of my head right now, but essentially it's, you know, it's interesting to see, you know, you only need to pay $2 for the software, so there's much less of a barrier to entry, and that's one of the things that I really enjoy about it.
I'm all software. Ableton Live is what I use both in the studio and on stage. I have a bunch of hardware, but it's mostly just for live performance. Like year by year, I just get more and more call in the box, which has been just all software, various plugins and samples, and yeah, just like
I will say
that
software doesn't screw up as much.
Yeah,
it's almost like having a band member that may screw up on you. It's sort of the fun of working with real hardware is, you know, sometimes it might crash or, you know, just delete your data for no reason, and Maybe it's like a band member showing up to a show drunk or something.
Yeah, but if you do want to get into, like, you know, making chiptune music or electronic music or any music, just know that there's lots of different options out there. You know, just experiment with lots of different things, see what works for you, because everyone has a different approach and there's no one right way.
Hey guys.
Hey.
Have you guys ever tooled around with anything from the 16-bit era? Like, say, Super Nintendo or Genesis?
So, nobody has written software to sequence, at least natively, on the Super NES.
Actually, not for Super NES, but there is a VGM tracker for Sega Genesis.
Right.
Just so to let you know.
Genesis is a slightly different beast. You know, there are people who have made Super NES-type music. What they do is they rip the samples because it's sample-based. They're really chintzy, awful samples, which have their own little character to them. So I have done like a Super NES-inspired track, which is essentially I just imported samples into Fruity Loops and then created loop points, and it's really strange. But essentially, there aren't a lot of people making Super NES-type music, but there are people making Genesis-type music, and there's a specific reason for that. The chip in the Genesis is actually the same chip that's in like these old Yamaha keyboards that were super popular in the 80s called the DX series, and essentially every single 80s hit used the DX series. It uses this type of synthesis called FM synthesis, which uses math and crazy vibrato to make overtones, and it's literally the densest, awful topic I could ever get into right now. but it uses weird, weird math to make sounds. And so the Genesis has a very particular sound. It's called FM synthesis. And so there are people making Genesis music, but not really so much with Super NES stuff, except for like one guy who... Yeah, except for Mario Paint. That's literally the only sequencer that exists is Mario Paint. I'm kind of hoping somebody, like, you know, hacks that ROM in order to, like, include more samples or something like that. I think that'd be cool, but what do I know?
From a very different side of that question, I used to only do 8-bit NES music as far as remixes, but now with the band, we're starting to branch out in some 16-bit stuff. So tonight we'll be playing Mario Kart for the SNES, or songs from that, Final Fantasy IV, and Link to the Past.
Nice. I have a guy working on, this is kind of a, I don't know, future project secret thing that isn't a secret anymore, but I'm doing a remix album for an album that I put out in 2006 called The Call, which is a more traditional hip-hop album. But a friend of mine, who actually is a Washingtonian by the name of Coffin Pop, is doing a complete remix, like overhaul of the music, and he's only using sounds and samples from the Super Nintendo. So it's coming out really good so far. He gave me a couple of the tracks, and I noticed some Link to the Past, you know, sounds and things like that. But so it will be totally sampled from the Super Nintendo. So that's what we're working on next. It should be a lot of fun.
I'm going to steal Dan's mic so I have to run around again. But I did have one question because I think everybody has a different take, is how do you define chiptunes? That's something I always like to ask, like, different artists. Just I think everybody has a different definition of like what chiptunes, and there's like different like subgenres almost, and I'm just kind of interested in that approach.
Nice. I was going to ask that too, because every time I'm on a panel with Dan, I learn more and more about it. And Dan's the guy. He's been doing it before I even knew what it was. So he could definitely answer this question better than me. I always thought, and it's, we've gone around and done a lot of these panels, and I you know, make mistakes with the terminology a lot. I'm like, oh man, you're doing really, you know, you're doing awesome 8-bit music, and he's like, no, you know. So so definitely, Dan, you can address this one the best. And I think it was said in the beginning somewhere that chiptunes is when you use the actual software or when you use the actual
sound. Actual hardware.
The actual hardware.
Yeah,
so when you're coming out of the Nintendo or the Game Boy, it's chiptunes. But when you're using something else, it's not.
Well, that's the thing, is it is a very technical definition. Like, it's using old game software or old sound chips. You know, people have made songs out of refrigerators, I'm pretty sure. don't ask. But it's using old sound chips in order to, you know, create music. But Some of those chips can be hard to work with, either because the tools don't exist, and it's really cool because, you know, these are people that just make their own tools, and that's another cool part of the whole scene, just kind of creating their own instruments and their own tools. But essentially, people started to use modern tools to sort of emulate that sound, which is totally cool too. And so everything that, you know, was officially chip music and like stuff inspired by chip music kind of got mixed under the same banner, which is cool because, you know, we're all kind of going for the same goal. And it's a loose definition. You can be technical if you want, and some people will be more than others, but essentially, you know, him sampling stuff or even using a keyboard to use like a basic sounding square wave or something like that, that's still under the spirit of chip music.
Yeah, I've never called myself a chiptune artist, but I keep ending up on chiptune panels just from that loose association.
Yeah, and it's almost like a loose association to the sound palette that, you know, kind of harkens old, you know, type memories of whether it's playing Pokemon or doing whatever. And it's not exclusive to that. It's really a broad, awful definition now that is hard to nail down. But that's actually a good thing because it means that people are taking different approaches and also like making lots of different kinds of things. It's not like, no, this is not punk music because you used a keyboard, you know, or who, I don't know. I'm talking out of my ass again. But essentially, it is a loose definition now, especially with the inclusion of modern tools.
All right, we got to wrap things up, but we'll be around at the con. Come visit the Arcade Armageddon booth in the free play room. The top 20 placement there will get a free ticket to see the concert tonight. So come on down and give it a look.
Sweet. Nice. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thanks.